Hello from David Rutledge. Welcome to the Philosopher's Zone.
Let's say that metaphysically there is an answer to what is right, and if you think about it really deeply, you might come to the right answer. But now we have the problem of modern times. When I go through that, I come to a different answer than when you go through that. So we have the problem of moral conflict. So then the interesting question comes up. Is it possible for us to share a common moral life while at the same time really fundamentally disagreeing on what the metaphysical truths are?
We all love diversity, or at least we all say we do. But when it comes to diversity in moral frameworks, things can get a little uncomfortable. Moral perspectives can change from one society to the next, and as globalization brings people from very different cultures closer and closer together, our species finds itself with an ever-increasing burden of accommodation. Gerald Gauss has been thinking about all of this for a while, and he's come to the conclusion that diversity offers solutions as well as problems. He's speaking with Joe Gelonesi.
A lot of philosophers believe that we have a very good knowledge of what is really, truly the best way to organize human society. And that somehow, if we're going to do political philosophy, that should be our goal, is to find the best way to organize human society. I think the evidence is that we don't know what the best way of organizing human society is. We've been learning about it. What we thought about it 30 years ago isn't what we think today. So that much more important than thinking there's an ideal and charting a course to it is a process of social discovery, social epistemology, and learning in which we're constantly finding better ways of living together without any idea, as Amartya Sen said, of what the best way of living together even might be.
Well, this is particularly pertinent at a time where diversity is a big thing, that we talk about diversity a lot, and the Western world in particular has diversified quite greatly in the last 30, 40 years. And yet for some people it's a pretty uncomfortable situation that, in fact, a greater diversity, particularly greater moral diversity, leaves some people feeling uncomfortable. Is that just a necessary byproduct of this particular adaptive great capacity to learn and do things better as we go along?
It may well be. There's an interesting organization studies of diverse groups. And they set diverse groups on problem-solving tasks, and then they compare them to homogeneous groups on problem-solving tasks. And the interesting result is that people are happier in homogeneous groups, men with all men or women with all women. They think alike, and therefore they congratulate each other on their insights. People say, oh, that was a very good idea. So after the experiments, the homogeneous groups felt they actually did very well and felt very good about themselves as members of the group. In the heterogeneous groups, people didn't feel they actually did as well and were more uncomfortable in the group because they were challenged. But objectively, on all the tests, they actually had much better solutions than the homogeneous groups. So we have the interesting results that not only do the homogeneous groups feel happier, but they actually think they do better. And with the heterogeneous groups, don't believe they do as well as they do because people are being challenged and they're being made less secure than they are in the homogeneous group. So it does seem to be a dynamic that, in one sense, we're very comfortable with people who agree to us, and yet it does look like we don't actually get the best answers when we live in those sorts of societies.
If that were to hold true across society, that's quite a consequential thing that you've put your finger on there, that it may not feel like there's progress being made, but in fact there is.
Yeah, so that it would be understandable if we feel we weren't as happy, but we knew we were doing better. But we can see the pushback against diversity when we actually not only don't feel particularly happy, but maybe we don't even think we're doing as well because many more problems are pointed out. In a homogeneous group, the problems aren't pointed out, so everyone thinks we must have a pretty good solution. We know in the diverse groups that even our best solutions aren't as good as they might be. So, in fact, I think that could be, of course, this is just one experiment, but I think it could be an enduring dynamic which we need to take account of when we think about stability in a diverse society.
Mm. So clearly for you, the idea of all, a war of all against all in a society that's teeming with different ways of seeing the world isn't, in fact, a reality, or at least a Hobbesian universe isn't likely to happen around the corner if that diversity just gets out of hand, as it were.
Well, theorists of diversity point out that there's two tendencies in any diverse systems, and this is not just in human societies, in ecological systems. Diversity can cause lack of coordination, has a centrifugal tendency. So very diverse ecosystems have some tendency to split apart. On the other hand, the diverse ecosystems also have a tendency to learn better and quicker and to be more adaptive. So we shouldn't just say, oh, the more diversity, the better for a system, because we know that there's any system is going to, the internal conflicts can swamp its ability to learn. On the other hand, without diversity, the stability can be a stability which finds in new environments that it can't adapt. So the interesting question is how to coordinate or how to achieve some reconciliation between these two forces, the forces of coordination, which requires sometimes that we damp diversity on some issues, and the forces of learning and discovery, which require that we take diversity and try to learn from the conflicts that are produced by it. And one of the things I think we see with some societies as opposed to others is that their ways of handling previous diversity weren't able to learn new diversity. So you might think there's two ways in which you might handle diversity. One is to say, well, we have three different religions, and those three different religions are having conflict. So let's institutionalize some political system or some institutional system where all three religions get some say in how we're going to handle education or how we're going to handle funding of charities. That looked like a really nice solution to diversity, except it turns out not to be robust. It's stable for a long amount of time, but should a new group enter in, say, Muslims in Europe, who the traditional Christian groups aren't really happy about sharing responsibility with, that system breaks down. Other systems of ways of coping with diversity, I think, are more hospitable to adding new diversities. So it's not just can we handle the current array of diversity, but how do we handle new diversity that we can't anticipate? And sometimes the institutions do really well at handling the current array, but are really bad when we think about new sources of diversity entering in.
So is there an answer or is there a way of seeing how that new diversity could be handled better?
Well, there aren't answers because we're always learning. I think we have learned that, for example, in freedom of religion, we've learned something about the robustness of different ways of handling religious differences in the last 30 or 40 years. And I think we have some evidence to think that separation of church and state solutions turned out to be more robust than those who tried to integrate them into a state structure. So we learn piecemeal as we go along with different problems and different ways of trying to accommodate diversity.
One of the things that rubs up is obviously individual freedom versus, say, communal standards and rights and beliefs. And I know that social norms are an important concept for you when coming to work out how to deal with adjustments, how to deal with going forward. Tell me about social norms and their importance in this respect.
I think social norms are one of the least explored notions in moral philosophy. One of the things about moral philosophy as it's typically done, it's as a highly individualist enterprise. A philosopher thinks about what she believes is right, determines what she believes is right, believes that she should do it and other people should do it too. But there's no notion that what is right is something that a group hits upon collectively as they work out their common lives. So consider an example of social norms, which are almost invisible to philosophers but have huge effect in people's lives, female genital cutting. Most philosophers are quite certain that female genital cutting is a bad thing. They reflect on their attitudes and that people should have attitudes that are against female genital cutting. Now, the interesting thing is if we look at the data in Africa, we find great differences among African countries in what their attitudes are. So surveys of attitudes in some African countries find support, male support and female support female genital cutting, that is, they have positive attitudes towards it, and so it's not that surprising that, in fact, we have practices of female genital cutting. But in other African countries, we see something quite different, that there's very strong disapproval of female genital cutting and yet very strong practice of it. So the traditional moral philosopher who says reflect on what's right and do it is perplexed by the fact that people have reflected on what's right and they're not doing it. And one of the reasons that that's the case, at least I think the social science is indicating, is that we're extraordinarily sensitive not just to what we think is right, but what we believe the normative expectations of others are. As we evolved, we didn't just evolve to have personal attitudes towards right and wrong, but to be sensitive to what our neighbors think we ought to do and what our neighbors expect of us. studies of cultures and female genital cutting suggest that they have very strong beliefs that other people think that they ought to cut. And therefore, the fact that their neighbors expect them to cut is very strong in getting them to cut, even when, in fact, they disapprove of it. Related is prison guards. Studies of prison guards in the United States found that their attitudes towards violence towards prisoners is actually quite more liberal, much more negative than you would expect. But they also have a strong belief that their fellow guards expect them to be prisoners. So when we think of morality in a very individualistic way, we don't sufficiently appreciate the extent to which our moral views and our social lives are not just determined by our own conclusions about morality, but by what our beliefs that our neighbors expect us to do something. We seem to be very sensitive to those beliefs. I think the importance of social norms is to alert us to how important it is to satisfy the norm of expectations of our fellows and groups.
Mm. And often the difficulty with that is not really knowing what your fellows think. You think you know what they are thinking, but privately, some of those don't believe in some of those practices. There's that problem in trying to bring that to the surface, isn't there?
Absolutely. We get caught in belief traps. We all believe something false about what the other person believes. Christina Bicchiari has done wonderful work trying to explore when norms are based on these belief traps and when norms are based on attitudinal support by the members of the population. Norms that are based on belief traps tend to be norms that are more easily undermined because as people discuss each other's beliefs, they can see that they had false beliefs about each other. On the other hand, norms that are more supported by attitudes tend to be more robust in the face of these sorts of discussions. But nevertheless, people are very sensitive about what others expect. And even if they don't approve of a norm, if most other people do in their group, and most of the people in their group expect them to do that, you very often find very high conformity to a norm, even if some of the people don't think it's a very hot norm.
Gerald Gauss on how diversity works and the role of social norms. He mentioned Christina Bicchiari there, and you may recall that she spoke on this very topic here on the Philosopher's Zone back in 2015. You can dig it out of our archives, which are a model of diversity. Gerald Gauss entertains some interesting strands for someone in his field, like the ideas of free marketeer Friedrich Hayek, for example, who featured in last week's program. That's another one to dig out. More on Hayek coming up in a moment, but just to mix things up a bit, Gerald Gauss is also into modern game theory and economic modelling.
So when it comes to social morality, I know that you think economics and game theory and social modelling is important. Why is that? Is it because of the complexity of the situation that we find ourselves in?
Many philosophers are skeptical of modelling. I've been at conferences where some of my work and other modelers' work has been presented, and the philosophers make jokes. So here's another model's walking into the room. But philosophers are always modeling. Consider Rawls in A Theory of Justice. Rawls had the problem that he wanted to know what rational and reasonable people who were fair-minded and wanted to live in a just society but nevertheless disagreed, what sort of principles of justice would be justified to them? Interesting philosophical problem. But Rawls also saw that to get any traction on that problem, he needed to make some simplifications and idealizations. So he said, well, let's look at individuals who are only rational and fair-minded, and we don't know any of their other concerns. And let's look at individuals who have very restricted information sets, who don't really know much. And let's look at individuals who, given this information set, will make the rational choice. His argument was, then we'll decide on these his two principles of justice. Now, that was a model. It took a complicated problem, tried to identify what the fundamental variables were, and saw how those fundamental variables would work out. I'm working on, in my own work right now, some what are called agent-based models, and I'm concerned with to what extent will people who not only disagree about what is morally best, but also who disagree on how important it is to share moral rules with each other, will they ever be able to share moral rules? Now, intuitively, you think if they disagree both about what the rules are, what the rules should be, and they also disagree about how much they really care about living with others according to the same rules, certainly they'll never agree on the rules. But in some of the simulation I've been running, it's often the case that nevertheless they'll converge on the same rules. Now, this doesn't tell us that real people will do this in all circumstances, but it allows us to see the dynamics of sharing and when sharing is more plausible, better than simply intuitively reflecting on the problem. So in the end, I think philosophers always model in some ways, but they tend to be resistant to formalizing the model. They tend to be resistant to using mathematical tools like game theory. I don't think it's so much that they don't like modeling, but I think that most moral philosophers don't like mathematics.
And also, there is obviously a metaphysical belief, or possibly, that there is, that you can come to know the right, the good, and the just. So there obviously is a fundamental difference in the approach to what actually makes for a moral life.
I'm not sure. Mm-hmm. I'm willing to say that the intuitionists might be right about this. There are times that I'm a little skeptical, for example. Jonathan Haidt has some good work which makes us wonder whether intuitions really are rational reflections or whether they're actually sort of ex post rationalizations of non-rational processes. But let's say that the intuitionists are right. Let's say that metaphysically there is an answer to what is right, and if you think about it really deeply, you might come to the right answer. But now we have the problem of modern times. When I go through that, I come to a different answer than when you go through that. So we have the problem of moral conflict, which isn't a very different problem than religious citizens faced in the 16th century. I think there's an answer to whether there's God. This is not a subjective or relativist point, but we can't agree on it. So then the interesting question comes up. Is it possible for us to share a common moral life while at the same time really fundamentally disagreeing on what the metaphysical truths are? We have different perspectives, and each says, my perspective is metaphysically correct. In the 16th century, it was thought, well, under those conditions, people can't share any sort of common social moral life, or what Rawls called a common moral constitution, a framework for their social living. My point isn't that the intuitionists are wrong, but that the intuitionists aren't giving us an adequate basis for sharing a social life. Because when you bring your intuitions against me, I'm not going to accept those intuitions if I disagree. So then, like two religious citizens, we have to say, well, given that I don't think you have the correct God, is there any way for us to living together? I don't think you have the correct intuitions. So still, can we in any way abstract from that to find a common way of living together? So in my models, there's no assumption that someone's not right about this. The question is, do I only care about being right in the sense I would rather be right alone in life or close to right and also be able to share a life with you? So an interesting question that we haven't thought is, how close do I have to be to my best view, what I think is the truly correct view, for me to say, well, it's not, if I was the ruler of the world, this is not the way we should live together, but it's not a bad way of living together, given my view of the world. It's one we can share.
Just the same, there seems to be tensions along the lines of, and I imagine people might point to something like Brexit or the rise of Donald Trump or the arguments over things like same-sex marriage, that there is some difficulty there in trying to get that middle ground or that ground where public reason sort of meets to some degree.
Sure. But that's because we haven't worked out our problems. There's not an answer to this. On many issues, we've worked out mutually acceptable ways of living that are stable and robust. We teach our children those ways of living. But because it's always a process of discovery, we have moral conflict. And moral conflict is sometimes I have to stand on my perspective, and I can't see how to coordinate. What we find is that often, but not always, that sort of moral standoff gives rise in the future to new solutions. As people spend a lot of time in conflict, they often start backing off from conflict and finding new ways to do things. But we shouldn't think there's answers that, no, now there's a public reason answer and we can always get along. What we find is that we solve some things, new things come up, we have new conflicts, and we try to find new ways to handle those. And we'll never have a society without conflict, which is a good thing. If we ever got to the society where we all bought on to all the rules, then there would be very little motivation for moral learning, for moral discovery, and we would be stuck sort of where we are, which is probably not the place we want to end up.
Now, your work, recent work, is on Hayek. Now, there's a name which is often not seen in the same circles as, say, moral philosophy. Tell me what you're doing there and why it's of interest to this question of how we ought to live.
Oh, gosh. You know, there's nothing good you can get in moral philosophy. We're trying to talk about Hayek. In moral philosophy, Hayek is usually introduced as a libertarian, and that's always a bad sign that things aren't going to go well. But Hayek was actually a really sophisticated theorist. He came up with some of the earliest conjectures about complexity, some of the earliest conjectures about the nature of social evolution and the relation to social norms and rules. One of the things Hayek suggests is that the social rules we have are, to a large extent, the process of cultural evolution. Now, once something is a product of social evolution, one of the implications is we're not sure of all the functions it performs. We can look at it and see some of its functions, but we can be quite surprised by other functions that we never knew it had. If that's the case, if our rules, no matter how important we think they are, we're not quite clear of all the ways they're important. We can't do, as some constructivists would like, a consequentialist analysis, knowing everything they do, because we don't, because they're products of evolution. So what does Hayek say? Hayek is going to say, one of the things we're going to be very suspicious of is someone who gives us a so-called theory of justice that tells us to recreate it all from scratch. We're not sure all the functions that it's performing. We're not sure because of complexity theory, its relation to other moral rules. To scrap them all, probably, as Karl Popper said, is going to lead to a dysfunctional society. It doesn't mean the rules as they are good. It doesn't certainly mean they shouldn't be changed, but it does probably mean that the changes should be, as Popper said, more on the margins, exploration. As Hayek said, one of the valuable things you can do for moral reform is just start disobeying a rule and see what happens. If we find that people start disobeying rules and nothing bad is happening, that might be a good sign that these weren't good rules to begin with. So the Hayekian view, I think, it is not one of reconstructing by grand philosophical theories.
Mm. And just finally, the role of the law and the role of being corrected by the law in a situation like that. Where do you see that? Because you just said that, you know, maybe you should try not following a particular rule and see how that turns out. Where does the law fit in with this?
Let me make two observations, one about the relation of law and social morality and one about the role of punishment. One of the things that's been found lately, which, again, has almost been invisible to legal philosophers because social morality has been invisible to them, is that law which departs too far from social norms tends to be ignored. For example, in Africa, almost every African country has laws against female genital cutting. That to make a law against something is not to say that it won't happen. A really good example is in Bogota, Colombia. The mayor of Bogota had been a student of social norms, and he saw that people in Bogota didn't pay attention to a number of rules, from homicide to traffic rules. So one thing he did was to try to cut down traffic fatalities by getting people to actually obey the traffic law. But until people thought there was a social norm supporting obeying traffic law, they wouldn't obey the law. So what he did is he replaced the police on the corners with mimes to make fun of people who disobeyed the law. And he also gave out over something like between 200,000 and 300,000 cards, which were thumbs up and thumbs down cards, so that when a driver did something wrong, someone would go thumbs down to show it wasn't just the law that said this. It was, you know, the people were saying it was a norm against it. And he managed to greatly reduce traffic fatalities. He also greatly reduced homicides in a sort of similar program. And his program was, if you want an effective law, the law has to, in some sense, march with the norms. A law that simply tells people what to do when their social morality says there's nothing wrong with it turns out to be an ineffective law even under high degrees of punishment. And then we get to punishment. Punishment, which is not seen as legitimate, tends to either be ineffective or actually induce counterpunishment. So you can punish people, but if they don't think the punishment is for something the social norms accept should be punished, you find great deals of avoidance. And the punishment ratchets up and people are still avoiding it. Punishment is most effective to stabilize cooperation when that punishment is already supported by social norms. So yeah, we do have laws that support social diversity and which stop harassment in the workplace. But those laws have followed social norms. It wasn't the law just said, you know, in 1960 there can't be social harassment. Social norms changed in the 60s so that more and more people felt there was something not right about social harassment. Once that happens, the laws can formalize it, the laws can push it along, punishment can stabilize it. But without that intimate relation between social norms and the law is often ineffective, and people laugh at the law, as in many countries they do. You can legislate all day and no one's going to do anything about it because the social norms aren't in place that support that legislation.
And Gerald Gauss is Professor of Philosophy at the University of Arizona. He was speaking there with Joe Gelonesi. More details on the website, abc.net.au/rn. We are the Philosopher's Zone, and you'll find us on the program menu. Thanks this week to producer Diane Dean and sound engineer Judy Rapley. And I'm David Rutledge. I'll see you next time.